From NPR and WBUR, and today from New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and in New Hampshire, Democratic candidates are making their final pitches to voters ahead of the primary tomorrow. Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg are at the front of the pack in recent polls following the Iowa caucuses. We're also following developments at the White House today after President Trump started a purge of people who testified during the impeachment inquiry. NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving joins us now. Hi, Ron.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
And let's start with the big political news, the New Hampshire primary tomorrow. So much on the line for the candidates in terms of momentum and fundraising. Do you think we could see some candidates drop out on Wednesday after the results come in?
We probably will. Some of the minor players have been playing big in New Hampshire, trying hard, spending a lot of time there. They will probably fall away if they don't break out. At the same time, we're also looking at some of the people in the top tier of candidates who, if they don't finish, say, third or fourth or even fifth, might have a problem going forward, particularly a financial problem. And it may be shocking to some of her fans, but Elizabeth Warren really needs to do well tomorrow night because of the financial question and because she needs to break out before we move into some of these other primaries further away from her home state of Massachusetts. So she is needing a performance here. And I think if you heard her on Morning Edition on NPR this morning talking about the financial situation, hers, and also the situation that emphasizes money the way it does, and billionaire money in particular, in the party, is a concern for her and for the party going forward. We might also see a real pressure on Amy Klobuchar if she doesn't do well, although she's been rising in the polls. It might be a little late. And there are also people asking questions about Joe Biden's future. He needs to do at least respectably in New Hampshire.
Okay, we're going to be hearing a lot more about New Hampshire throughout the program because, of course, Robin is there, as she said. But let's focus on Washington for a moment, Ron, because some big news came late last week. The president fired two key witnesses in the impeachment trial, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman and Ambassador to the European Union Gordon Sondland. And Trump also let go of Vindman's twin brother, even though he had nothing to do with the impeachment inquiry. How have lawmakers reacted to that? We haven't heard that much from Republicans in protest.
There's not that much to say. If you are shocked, it would probably indicate you had not been paying attention to the last 3 years in Washington. And if you're not shocked, then you have to explain perhaps your attitude towards the process of impeachment. Several senators gave speeches saying they thought the president had pretty much learned his lesson from this impeachment episode, that now he was going to behave more like a normal president or more presidential fashion. And, well, the very first thing he did within 48 hours of that final vote last Wednesday was to start purging the people who had testified against him, sending them away from the center of power and making sure that everyone knew that they were going because they had testified against him. Now, whatever else we might hear to that effect, the president was quite clear.
Is it legal to fire somebody in retribution for what they testified about in Congress?
It might not be if they are fired in a particular way, but if they're reassigned away from the White House to another part of the government, say the Department of Army, as was the case with Lieutenant Colonel Vindman and his brother, that can be done. And that is within the powers of the president. These people serve as the ambassador to the European Union. Gordon Sondland served at the pleasure of the president. Mm-hmm. And the president's displeasure in this case could not have been clearer or more obvious in its source.
Well, the White House advisor Kellyanne Conway was asked on Fox News today whether more heads could roll at the White House. Conway did not answer that question directly, but instead blamed Democrats for criticizing the White House for the firings that have already happened.
This whole ridiculous words by Chuck Schumer today in a letter of retaliation, and the president is exacting revenge. And where? They're working at the Army where they were. They were detailed to the NSC. This is typical in a White House to have a detailee for a temporary period of time who then returns to what their full-time job is.
Ron, do you think there are others that could be on the chopping block? Is this going to continue?
Well, not Kellyanne Conway, apparently. She seems to be in no danger at all. But, you know, in
general, I wasn't
talking
about her, but I mean anybody else from the impeachment inquiry.
Well, she seems to be doing her job just right. And let's say that there are those who may have been closer to the edge, and some of those people probably do have something to fear if they have been seen as being independent voices or critical voices. And, you know, there were a lot of rumors on Friday about the president being displeased with his latest chief of staff, acting chief of staff Mick Mulvaney, who was on the job when things went south for the president. president last year, impeachment got going, some of which was to some degree encouraged by some of the things that Mick Mulvaney said, like, get over it, this is how we do business, mm-hmm. and so forth. Now, Mulvaney has never crossed swords with the president. There's no indication that he's been in any sense disloyal, but there were rumors going around about him, particularly because the president's bringing on some people who have been elsewhere mm-hmm. in Washington, Congress, and wherever, and giving them new responsibilities.
Ron, just briefly, let me ask you about the other big story in Washington today, which is the president's budget has just been unveiled. Now, this is not going to go anywhere in the Democratic-controlled House. But one thing that's interesting about it is it does not show the administration trying to deflate the ballooning federal deficit over the next many years.
You know, going back generations, the Republican Party was against Russia, against some of the social programs and social changes that were going on in the country, abortion, same-sex marriage, and against big budget deficits. But now, instead of a 10-year frame for trying to get that budget deficit down, it's a 15-year frame, and we're looking at trillion-dollar deficits as far as the eye can see.
That is Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. Ron, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, taking a break from politics, the Food and Drug Administration's ban on some popular flavored e-cigarettes has officially gone into effect, although a loophole in the policy allows vape shots to continue selling a disposable flavored cartridge. Still, in recent months, there have been fewer hospital admissions for vaping-related illnesses as states begin to crack down. But even as vaping takes up headlines, the cigarette is still king in Cleveland, and cigarette smoking rates are especially high, near 40% in predominantly African-American neighborhoods. IdeaStream's Ann Glosser reports on a new strategy for helping black smokers quit.
53-year-old Jan Johnson smoked a dozen cigarettes a day for about two decades.
I would go to bingo at least four times out of the week, and at bingo, it was just the thing to do.
When her apartment building went smoke-free in 2018, she knew something would have to change. On a bulletin board, she saw a notice for a research study testing whether a text messaging program could help people stop smoking, and she decided to sign up. Each of the 100 or so participants in the pilot study received 6 weeks of daily texts that shared encouraging video messages, like this one.
Ask other smokers in your home to quit with you. Or if they aren't ready, ask them to smoke outside.
But the texts weren't one-size-fits-all messages like you'd find online at smokefree.gov. For the test group, there are messages designed specifically for the African-American community.
We are a strong people. We've had to overcome many obstacles and fight hard to get what we want. And you will need this strength to be successful quitting smoking.
We talk about the relationship of the tobacco industry with African-Americans and its roots that date back to slavery.
That's researcher Monica Webb Hooper, who conducted the study for Case Western Reserve University.
We talk about the targeting of the tobacco industry for menthol cigarettes, which are known to be more difficult to quit and contain greater rates of toxins and tars. We also talk about the cultural assets and strengths that would be relevant to this group, such as the emphasis on spirituality, religion, the emphasis on family and community engagement.
Hooper says that people receiving the culturally specific texts were more engaged with the program and more likely to be smoke-free at their six-week follow-up than those who got the standard texts from smokefree.gov. Jan Johnson credits the program for her success in quitting.
I used to use oxygen like when I sat up and laid down, but now I'm only on oxygen at night.
She says she still watches the text videos when she needs help.
I remember the one with the lady that had to use a voice box. That one right there hit me below the belt.
What Johnson doesn't remember, though, is feeling like the videos were tailored toward black smokers.
No, I kind of didn't look at it like that. I know that the doctor was explaining that in the black culture, this and that and the other, but no, it just really didn't stick out.
At the Cleveland Clinic, Community Relations Manager Rashida Larkin likes the idea of cultural specificity and says it could help broaden thinking and validate experiences, maybe even make people angry.
It takes it to a different level where they understand not only is this hurting you from a healthcare standpoint, but also how you are marketed to because of what you show up in the world, being a person of color, being a black woman, being a black man. It shows up and they are directly targeting you. It's a full-on attack.
The overall smoking rate for the city of Cleveland is 29%, higher than many other major cities. And in some heavily African-American Cleveland neighborhoods, as many as 40% of adults smoke. That's why CASE's Monica Webb Hooper says it's critical to find new ways to help more Black smokers quit.
This group tends to be less likely to quit smoking. This group also suffers disproportionately from a range of tobacco-associated conditions, not only cancer, but heart disease, stroke, diabetes, infant mortality. All these things are related to tobacco use. So it is imperative that any health agenda include tobacco use.
Hooper says more research is needed, but ultimately she'd love to have a free texting program tailored to smokers in the Black community available on the National Cancer Institute's website, where smoking cessation programs targeting pregnant women, teens, and other groups already exist. For Here and Now, I'm Ann Glosser in Cleveland.
We're in New Hampshire ahead of tomorrow's primary, so of course we had to visit an old friend. This is the Canterbury Country Store, north of Concord, an old-fashioned, white-clabbered, combination post office general store that Tony Halla has been struggling to keep afloat in the modern era. We've been visiting her for years. Incoming!
How are you? Can you believe
it? Tony's a proud, self-described curmudgeon and fierce supporter of President Trump.
So how are you?
Well, I'm the same old bitch that I know. I'm the same old termagant. Edit that, please. Termagant. I found out termagant is, you know how men have curmudgeon?
Yeah.
We don't have anything, do we? But by accident, I found in the dictionary the word termagant. Quarrelsome, ill-tempered, ready to do battle. So I'm not the same old whatever. I'm the same old termagant.
You haven't changed.
No.
In 4 years. No. Have you changed any of your opinions? Because
you want to know if I'm still a reflexive Republican? It's very difficult to be right now. I have to admit that things are rife with stress. The strife is, everybody's noticed it. It's not good.
I want to be clear. You know, we've spoken for years, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in the most recent primaries about President Trump, you were a very strong supporter.
Mm-hmm.
And what you liked about the president was his feistiness. What
yes.
other people might call he was being crude
yes.
and maybe
yes.
impolite,
yes.
that's what you liked. Is that wearing on you a little bit?
Well, it got worse. And his outspokenness changed from outspokenness to, I don't even know how to describe it. And he became serious white trash. You can put that in there, not probably not. But he became very, very crude, more so than he was. I mean, he was a misogynist, and I was comfortable enough with that from being from the 50s and stuff. And he hadn't changed quite so much during the last primary.
What do you think about what some people are calling his vindictiveness? I mean, summarily firing Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, who has a Purple Heart from an injury in Iraq and came from the Soviet Union.
No argument whatsoever.
You thought that was wrong?
Yes, I did. There were a lot of things that were wrong, but I don't understand enough about some of them to have an opinion. And I don't know enough about the impeachment proceedings when it went to the Senate. Were they allowed to do that, have no witnesses? I'm not really sure.
Did that bother you a little bit?
Sure. It would bother anyone, I would think, even one as single-minded as I. Yeah. A lot of it has harsh, punitive, vindictive, not good.
It sounds like you've had a lot of reflection over the last...
Yeah. Yeah. But I still don't know what I'm doing or how I feel. I really don't feel comfortable with any of the Democrats, and there are no Republicans.
So you don't even know what you're going to do in 2020.
I don't. I'm not comfortable with any of them. Yeah. It's a shame.
2807, please.
Well, we're frankly stunned. Tony was such a reliable Trump supporter.
Oh.
One of her customers, Huey Fifield, still is. He owns a sawmill down the road. Another, Stephanie Jackson, never was. Tony refers to her as a token liberal. We start with Stephanie. So Tony was just telling us that unlike the last couple visits we've had, she's really feeling unsure about her past staunch report for Donald Trump. Yeah, you're looking at her.
You've come to your senses.
No, see?
When did we get to Huey?
Well, Huey, weigh in. Come on over here.
Yeah.
Huey.
What's up?
Your thoughts on the conversations that happen here in the country store. What are you feeling about the race? Do you have a candidate?
I feel it's a Democratic race. I mean, they're all racing, and they're going to cut their own throat because I think Trump will beat them.
And are you still a staunch supporter?
Yeah, because things have been good. I mean, he's a little coarse, maybe, with his language, but he gets his point across. And I think he's helped the working people pretty well. I know I sold more lumber this year than I usually do.
From your sawmill, you sold more lumber.
Yeah.
Stephanie, we're hearing from some people in New Hampshire that, you know, politics is always a conversation here in New Hampshire. I mean, this is in your bloodstreams. But that this year in particular, it's gotten a lot fiercer. Do you feel that, yeah. Stephanie? Or Huey, you feel that?
Yeah.
And I think in part it's because of the of Trump's general offensive behavior.
Huey, and I'm wondering, when somebody criticizes him, do you take that personally? You don't?
No. Don't bother me any.
And I don't think they're bad people because they're misguided about Trump. You and I are on opposite sides of the thing.
Yeah, well, that's cool.
But we're both good people.
Thank you. You want a bag?
Nope.
Okay.
Listening in, other customers, including Robbie Nigel, who supports Donald Trump.
I just believe in what he does and how he is. I like how hard he is because that gets a job done.
Tony has been a staunch Trump supporter, and this is why we're bringing it up. She just said that it's just the coarsening, the vindictiveness, the punishment, firing a Purple Heart Iraq War vet.
What do you expect from a mob boss?
Okay, not a Trump supporter here. Okay. What this gentleman just said is how Trump is being viewed.
It can go both ways. I mean, it's probably how you brought up. Actually, my neighbor, we have coffee every morning. And we talk about this. The news is on, and it comes up, and that's what we talk about.
Does it ever get heated if somebody hears you talking and doesn't agree? It's a small town. You're overhearing.
I'm sure people dislike views of what other people think, and I don't take it against anybody.
Well, this is interesting. Who was the gentleman who... Yes, over here. Can I just do mine? What is your name, sir?
Oh, Chris Rugerberg.
And you characterized the president as a mob boss.
Well, yes.
But what do you say to neighbors like Huey and Robbie who are, chatting over there? It's the economy, and Huey's selling more lumber at his sawmill.
Well, I mean, I say that Trump, he's very good at pulling the wool over people's eyes. And, I mean, the economy is doing well for some people and not for others. I mean, if you look at the economic figures, they're pretty much a continuation of what Obama finished when he left the White House.
There you go. Thank you very much.
Well, pretty soon this old country store feels like a stage with characters entering and exiting. Here's Rick Crockford, who calls himself a progressive.
I would like a kind president. Yeah, I don't. Franklin, I think, said something about that you don't need to be unkind to prove your strength. You don't need to be cruel to be formidable. You can be kind.
Hey, Tony, is this the kind of customer, neighbor, who's rubbing off on you a little bit?
I hope not. But, no, he makes sense for someone from the other party, or the other area, shall we say.
He's a good person.
The other pole.
Yes, he's a good person. But I also, the word kind is, that could mean being soft sometimes.
Yeah, I think, and I'm not sure... A little bit of softness every once in a while is that big. I mean, yes, you can make mistakes, be taken advantage of.
You know, I've been in parts of the country where this kind of a conversation between someone like Rick, who's a progressive, and someone like you, Tony, who's characterized yourself as in the past a staunch Trump supporter, wavering a little but still staunch conservative, I think it's fair to say, that you could stand civilly and even have this conversation.
It's fun. It's fun for many of us.
Stephanie.
Well, no, I consider Tony and I friends, and she considers me a raving liberal.
Oh, yes. Knee-jerk. The worst kind. You know.
Not quite true.
There is something to be said for the scale of a small town where if the storekeeper and I didn't get along, I don't have another store to go to, really.
Right, so right. Always the pragmatist.
Always the pragmatist. Pragmatism does have a place.
You have to get along.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, we want to, also. Right. We want to get along.
Yeah, we agree to disagree or something, and most of us have a good time disagreeing. It doesn't really have an impact on things with our relationship.
Well, I want to thank you all. It's just,
oh, you're welcome.
We just, so Tony, we're going to see you in 4 years?
Of course. Well, yeah, I trust so. It's a shame to even think of something like this not being here.
Yeah. Yeah, I would imagine you're running into the buzzsaw of why go out on a cold day like this when you can go online?
When you can go to Amazon.
Wow, and I can't even, you know, it sounds like you're saying that the conversations here are kind of what, you know, weave the fabric of your community. This store goes, some of that goes.
Oh, yes. A lot of that goes.
If you don't have a community place where people can, in a very friendly way, be adversaries, then they sit in their little hidey hole, and it builds and it builds, and people fester. And here, at least, I look, and there's a human face to the point of view that's diametrically opposed to mine.
And it's Tony.
And it's Tony, and it makes it much
more
better.
More palatable,
exactly.
We should all have a country store. Our every four-year visit with conservative Republican Toni Halla and her customers from across the political spectrum at the Canterbury Country Store in Canterbury, New Hampshire. By the way, the guy who said coffee, he's originally from New York.
I listen to Bullseye because Jesse always has really good questions.
What did John Malkovich wear when he was 20?
I don't know how to describe it.
Bullseye. Interviews with creators you love and creators you need to know from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
The World Health Organization now says the death toll from coronavirus has surpassed the toll from SARS 17 years ago. In mainland China, the number of deaths is still growing, and yesterday the government reported the biggest one-day death toll, 97. Joining us now from Hong Kong is NPR science reporter Rebecca Hersher. Rebecca, nearly 100 deaths yesterday, and just today, President Xi Jinping was seen wearing a mask and surgical gown while visiting a hospital that's treating coronavirus patients. What's the latest?
Well, what those numbers tell us is that the virus is still spreading. You know, those 97 deaths, it takes the total number of deaths from the virus to 908. And the total number of confirmed cases, it's more than 40,000 now. Although a lot of public health officials, they actually think that might be an undercount. There were tens of thousands of cases that Chinese health authorities are still calling suspected, as opposed to confirmed cases. And really what the numbers make clear, the epicenter of this outbreak is still Hubei province. The vast majority of the new deaths and cases are happening there. The city of Wuhan is still in lockdown, although a lot of people in other parts of China are slowly returning to work.
What about in Hong Kong where you are? I've got a friend who's in business there in Hong Kong. His family has flown back to the United States because the kids are out of school for the next month at least. And he's having to work from home. What about where you are, though, in Hong Kong?
Yeah, well, you know, you mentioned SARS, and the thing to remember about Hong Kong, and it's really present here, is that it was hit really hard by the SARS outbreak in 2003. Just to put it in context, the World Health Organization, it says about 750 to 800 people died of SARS total. At this point, we're at 908 from coronavirus. But here's the thing. Based on what we know right now, you're actually a lot less likely to die if you get coronavirus than if you got SARS. The vast majority of coronavirus cases are mild. Only about 3% of confirmed cases have been critical. So you see that reflected here in Hong Kong. There's not panic, but there is a real seriousness about making sure that people are being careful, that they're wearing masks, that they're protecting themselves.
And as you walk around the streets, is everybody wearing a mask?
Yeah, absolutely everybody. I mean, virtually everybody. I'm wearing a mask when I walk around. You know, mm-hmm. if you're not wearing one, people shoot you a dirty look. Like, are you not protecting me from you? Mm-hmm. I don't know you.
What about the cruise ships? We've been following the situation on that Japanese cruise ship that has been kept offshore. 60 new cases on that ship. People with the virus are being pulled off the ship. What's going on with the cruise ships? And are the passengers able to be tested to see if they have the coronavirus?
Japanese authorities are now saying they're going to try to test as many people as they can. Passengers are posting on social media saying they're getting kind of antsy, and you can see why. They've been stuck on this ship in port for a week already. On the flip side, here in Hong Kong, there was a ship that was being held in port. The passengers and crew from that ship, there were more than 3,000 of them, they were allowed to leave over the weekend because there were no positive tests found on that ship. One of the real questions that scientists are trying to nail down that would affect people on these ships is exactly how long it takes between being exposed to the virus and showing symptoms. That obviously influences how long you need to isolate people who you think might have been exposed to the virus, right? So the more data about the virus that scientists have, the more accurate those calculations can get.
That is NPR science reporter Rebecca Hersher joining us from Hong Kong with the latest on the coronavirus outbreak. Rebecca, thank you.
Thanks so much.
We're at Manchester, New Hampshire's Puritan Ice Cream, the takeout arm of the city's iconic Puritan backroom restaurant, takeout stand, and banquet hall's empire, which was founded and is still run by freshman Democratic Congressman Chris Pappas's family. On this primary weekend, he's here talking to a forum of university students.
We need to be thinking ahead about how we can get to kids early.
Pappas is up for re-election in November. His party, as we know, is in a tug of war between progressives and moderates, but there's also a bit of a tug of war between the older guard and a new crop looking to change the status quo. Pappas was a state rep at 22. Now 39, he's New Hampshire's first openly LGBTQ federal lawmaker. One of several things he has in common with 38-year-old presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg, they both also attended Harvard. But don't assume Pappas will automatically vote for Buttigieg. Politics takes more efforting than that here, and he's been marinating in it at the family restaurant his whole life.
It's been open for over 102 years, so we're even older than the New Hampshire primary, believe it or not.
We sat down Saturday with Congressman Pappas at another iconic institution, the bookstore-slash-cafe Bookery in Manchester, next to windows plastered with cutouts of candidates' heads. He told us, like a lot of voters here, he still has not chosen a candidate.
I went into the debate last night undecided, and I came out even more undecided. You know, as a Democrat, I've decided about one thing, and that's that we need to replace this president. And I think that's what most of the voters in the Democratic primary here are going through. They like a number of the candidates. They're assessing the field, but they understand that winning is critically important if we're going to move forward on our agenda.
And what are you saying you're not seeing someone who can do that?
No, I think we see a number of candidates that are viable. I think New Hampshire has an important opportunity this year, not just to shape the field, but to continue to shape the terms of the national debate. That's what's made New Hampshire so special over the 100 years that it's had the first in the nation primary.
As you know, a lot of people don't agree with you. A lot of people say, why both Iowa and New Hampshire, why are they going first, given that they're not diverse, don't represent the electorate?
There's a case to be made for having states with a smaller scale to go at the head of the calendar, and that's why both parties have decided to put together a calendar that has these four first states who I think collectively represent the diversity that America has to offer. This should be about conversations, and I think we can have that here in a more purposeful way than a larger contest in a bigger state. This is a live and let live state. You know, I was blessed to become the first LGBT member of Congress from New Hampshire. And so I think that, you know, we understand that there are differences. And across the country, you know, diversity is a strength in America. But I think New Hampshire voters like to make sure that everyone's included in the process.
You know, it's funny, you mentioned, of course, that you are, as you said, the first LGBT congressman elected from this state. Well, some people don't even know that.
Well, I think that means we've come a long way, right? Where someone's sexual orientation, who they love, you know, is not something that would eliminate you from being able to be involved in politics today. So the fact that we have an out person who's a major candidate for president right now is pretty remarkable. I never thought I would see that in my lifetime growing up in New Hampshire.
He did not think he could go into politics, even though he felt this need to serve because he was gay. And you're saying you felt the same thing.
Yeah, I knew I had an interest in politics. I was a volunteer early on. And, you know, when you grow up in New Hampshire, it's all around you, right? And so you can see avenues to get involved and help out. And I found that exciting at an early age. You know, I never thought I'd you know, be able to really, you know, have a career as an out politician.
Well, on the other hand, I'm wondering if you worry about Pete Buttigieg's possibility because of that. I mean, we see the video from Iowa where the voter cast her ballot for Pete Buttigieg and then found out that he was gay and wanted her ballot back.
I think when candidates are upfront and open and honest about who they are, I think that inspires confidence that they will be a trustworthy leader. So I think it's an asset for him.
Well, when you say you brush up against politics when you grow up here, you literally did. Your parents had a restaurant here in Manchester. I mean, who are some of the candidates that you'd see?
The first campaign I remember was the 88 campaign.
Dukakis, I'm trying to do the year. Who is that?
I was a big Dukakis fan. As a Greek-American, I was proud to see him running for president. But I also liked Bob Dole on the Republican side, too. I thought he was a real honest guy, you know, a war hero. And I was sad to see him lose the primary to George Bush here that year.
And how old were you?
I was 8.
And also, I think you tell a story about Bill Clinton coming into the kitchen of the restaurant to watch a ball game or something.
Yeah, he came in the night before the New Hampshire primary after he had finished campaigning for the day. You know, he's on the verge of this big comeback, and he spent over an hour with the staff at the restaurant watching a basketball game in the kitchen. You know, it just shows the real human connection that can exist here. You really get a sense of who people are.
We're looking out the window of the bookery here, and what's passing by, it's amazing, this truck, it's festooned with Trump flags and signs, God bless America and God bless Donald Trump. Apparently, you are on President Trump's radar. WMUR is reporting that the White House has their eye on you after you spoke about your impeachment vote to indict. Your thoughts on hearing that? The White House has their eye on you.
Well, first of all, I like how the truck that just went by and, you know, festooned with Trump paraphernalia had a plow on the front. So I think, you know, New Hampshire voters, while they like to get across their message, they're practical as well.
Yes.
And utilitarian. Look, this is a competitive state, and I represent a competitive district that hasn't reelected anyone since 2008. So this is one of a couple dozen districts across the country where Donald Trump won in 2016, and there was a Democrat who won in 2018 in the race for Congress. So that's on the target list, and that's really the battlefield for the next race for Congress.
One of the Republicans trying to run against you in November, Matt Maurer, accused you of voting with Nancy Pelosi 100% of the time, said you were nothing but a rubber stamp for socialist policies that will raise taxes on New Hampshire's middle class, and an impeachment crusade that voters have clearly rejected. This is a president who firmly believes in payback. Does that worry you? The spotlight is on you, or maybe on you?
I don't worry about that personally, but collectively, I worry that this president feels emboldened by the events of the last few weeks.
President Trump supporters would say he has every right to lash back because he was unfairly persecuted over, well, since his administration started. Does Bernie Sanders give you pause? Bernie Sanders has certainly appealed to voters, but when he gets on the national stage as the candidate and Donald Trump turns to him and says, "You're a socialist," is that something that worries you, especially since you're getting painted with the same stripe by Republicans running against you?
Yeah, well, it's a ridiculous attack on me. And, you know, I think that, you know, the voters of New Hampshire will see right through that. But I think we have to be pragmatic about how we talk about issues.
No, don't go with Medicare for All just yet?
It's not a proposal that I support. I think we should build on what we have that has shown that it can bring more people into the system and improve outcomes. There's an effort underway right now to repeal the ACA and, you know, invalidate it in court, which would take away health care from tens of millions of Americans. We've got to stop that and, I think, focus on costs and on the quality of coverage that people have.
Amy Klobuchar had a great line. She said the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, has a higher approval rating, I think 10 points, than President Trump.
Mm-hmm. But I think voters understand what it means now. You know, we expanded Medicaid here in New Hampshire, part of the ACA. That is the best tool we have to fight the opioid epidemic, which is raging in our state.
And do you think the Democratic Party is now wounded with a loss in the impeachment trial and then coupled with the Iowa caucuses being such a debacle? It just, some feel it has been bruised.
I think that with the issue of impeachment, you always need to tread very carefully when you consider that matter. And I think members of the House did just that. The evidence piled up in a way where we could not turn our backs and felt we had to act in accordance with our oath. We understand that the political chips are going to fall where they may, but that we have a case about trying to make progress for the people. That's where our focus has got to be, on a positive agenda. You know, we'll see what the voters of New Hampshire have in store. I know we're going to get quick results, and that the rest of the country will be able to follow suit.
So, Congressman Chris Pappas, it's, you know, a few minutes later than when we began talking. Have you made up your mind on your candidate?
Not yet.
That reminds me, there's a hashtag I've been seeing. Hashtag, but I haven't made up my mind yet. You really haven't.
I thought Amy Klobuchar did very well in the debate last night. Hashtag, I haven't made up my mind yet.
Congressman, thank you.
Thanks for your time.
New Hampshire Congressman Chris Pappas at Bookery in Manchester. When he has a Republican opponent in November, we'll watch that race.
More art galleries are now serving dinner. Restaurants have been popping up in galleries, especially in major art cities like New York, London, and Los Angeles. But why? Let's bring in Magnus Resch. He's an expert on the art market and author of the book Management of Art Galleries. Magnus, art galleries with their own restaurants, is this a new phenomenon?
It's a very new phenomenon, but not so new to the art world. When you look at museums, most of major museums today have restaurants, including Michelin-star restaurants.
Because people want to eat while they're viewing art?
I think it has a dual strategy. One is museums attract a certain clientele which is willing to spend money on good food. And secondly, when it comes to galleries, there's also a real estate strategy that lies behind that. Galleries are in the business of creating environments and helping neighborhoods to develop. When you look at Chelsea in New York, for example, galleries moved in and then a couple of years later it became what it is today, a high rental real estate spot. So galleries are very good in doing this, and restaurants attract people.
Do you think that people are more willing to spend a lot of money on art when they are fully fed or when they're, you know, hanging out and enjoying themselves with a glass of wine?
I don't think the spillover effect goes that way. It isn't the way that people eat and then, oh, now I'm going to buy a work.
Right.
It's more like galleries need a spot where they can bring in clients to talk about business. Before they did it in other restaurants, now they do it in their own restaurants.
Now, is there pushback against this? I was speaking with somebody who is now retired but used to run a major art museum, and she said that she was very hesitant to allow a restaurant to go in.
I think that's a very old school view on the market. Today, the generation of new buyers, we want it all. We want to have parties, we want to have social events, educational events, but also food.
Do the artists like it?
I think artists, there's some artists that like it a lot. If you look at Damien Hirst, for example, one of the leading contemporary artists in the world, he has his own restaurant, which he opened in London. And in general, it's not a new idea to bring in great art into restaurants. Some restaurants are solely based on the idea of bringing great art into it. If you look at Sketch in London, for example, or Sushi Zamba, and even hotels are, when you look at the W in Miami, it lives by the culture that art creates.
And when there's art up in a restaurant or art up in a hotel, do people buy it?
I think this rarely happens. When you look at hotel lobbies and there's a name tag next to the artwork, I haven't heard stories of galleries who tell me, oh, a customer saw it in the lobby or in a restaurant and then bought it. It's more about the galleries being able to bring clients to this restaurant and say, hey, look at this artwork, it's hanging there. Clients who are already interested in the work go to these locations, see it, and this might trigger them to buy the artwork. It's not the other way around.
Okay, let's just take a step back for a second. How is the art market doing right now?
The art market is not in a good shape. The biggest problem is it's a conversion problem. So you see a lot of people going to art events, to art fairs and to museums, gallery openings and so on, but they don't buy. There are multiple reasons for this. I think the two biggest reasons is that dealers make it extremely difficult to buy an artwork. There's never the price next to an artwork. So you have to, I call it the beauty contest that you have to compete in. So you need to talk to someone, ask for the price and so on. That's not what we're used to. If I like to buy a luxury product, there's always the price written next to it. the second reason why people don't buy art is the lack of transparency. So once I have found out the price, I have no idea if this is overpriced or if it's underpriced, if it's a good deal or a bad deal. In any other luxury good, I can immediately compare the price to other prices offered by other galleries. In the art world, price transparency doesn't exist, and this prevents people from buying.
So who is buying art these days?
It's the, I call it the old school type of people. The average art buyer these days is 55. He's male, white, and comes from a finance background. I give you another data point. The number of art purchases, so the number of artworks that were bought, has gone down by 10% in the past 10 years. So less artworks, dramatically less artworks, were sold in a 10-year comparison. At the same time, prices at the top end have gone up dramatically. So we see really two worlds. One is the top end, where 25 artists compete in with five galleries and a couple of museums. Those people are making money, everyone else isn't.
So let's bring it back around to the original question. Do you think that if there's an art gallery out there that is struggling, that they should put a restaurant in, and at the very least, they'll sell some food?
But then it's not a gallery, then it's a restaurant, right? with art at the walls. Running a gallery is incredibly hard, maybe even harder than running a restaurant. So I wouldn't advise my kids to do either.
Okay. That is Magnus Resch, who's an expert on the art market and author of several books, including Management of Art Galleries. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. And Jeremy, our team, will be back at NHPR tomorrow, primary day. So we hope everyone joins us then. Here and Now. Because of the trade war with the U.S., China has stopped buying lobsters from New England.
There's usually 15 to 20 guys working, packing bins, packing boxes, of which we normally ship 300 a day. Today we ship none. Yesterday we shipped none.
That story and the latest from the New Hampshire primary next time here and now.